Well, hello there. Thank you for joining me today. I've got a pretty big file going here. I don't know how much of it I'll get through or if I'll need help getting it combined, but let's get started. But before I get started, interesting things going on here. Looks like the cops are getting safe zoned. Yeah, the cops. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently signed two bills aimed at shielding law enforcement officers from anti-police activists and increasing support for them. This bill makes for a no-go zone around police and first responders engaging in their duties, making it a second-degree misdemeanor for individuals to violate this rule, so you can't get any closer than 25 feet next to a cop. Remember, these are the same people that are such cowards, they had to have the down votes on social media not visible. But before I get started, I'm going to read you this two-paragraph piece that I would encourage you to listen to very carefully. Britain's King Charles will wear robes of crimson and purple silk velvet at his May the 6th coronation, which were once again worn by his grandfather, King George the 6th, at his coronation in 1937. The harlot of Babylon, as described in the Book of Revelation, is depicted wearing purple and scarlet garments adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls. Her attire symbolizes royalty, power, and wealth. All that wealth that I must say they gave to themselves off the backs of the working class. But yeah, pretty funny that for his coronation, which happened last May, he wore robes of crimson and purple silk. And the harlot of Babylon wore purple and scarlet garments. So they're also working on bills this week because the Middle East is blowing up. Well, why do I always say look at the beginning? Well, the Middle East turns out to be a pretty fascinating story that I'll be getting to today. So now they're running around in circles, and they say that one bill will ratchet up sanctions on Iran, and another will condemn the country for drone attacks over the weekend that Iran launched after an Israeli strike killed two Iranian generals early this month. Iran called the attack self-defense, but in a statement, Biden condemned the aggression and reaffirmed the U.S.'s support of Israel. It's pretty funny, huh? Well, it's not going to be pretty funny in a bit because this is all just being so staged, right? And right now in this country, they're passing laws to make sure that, oh, I don't know, the new migrants can have handguns. They're the loser in New York who's talking about deputizing private citizens during emergencies. Yeah, this stuff's going to get pretty crazy. But before I get started, let me tell you what I have over in the show notes. And I have a lot of files. I have been just reading and reading and reading. How we got there. Now, I don't think this show is going to take me that long today because I've already cracked the case, but I want to explain to you how I got here. I have the first file is on Law Enforcement Support Office. That is the group, the 1033 group that is giving weapons to all of the local law enforcement. So you might want to read up on that bill. They've now changed the name to, it says Law Enforcement Support Office. Yes, we'll support you with tanks and guns and all that. Next article, how the British divided up the Ottoman Empire. Why were Jewish Zionists behind the Armenian Holocaust? A century on, why Arabs resent Sykes-Picot. That's a very interesting, sneaky deal they pulled. Jules Cambon, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and the Balfour Declaration, exposing Jewish machinations in World War I. The San Remo Conference. Start reading the Ottoman scramble for Africa. The Ottomans were also involved in the scramble for Africa. The intertwined history of the Illuminati, Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and Jesuits. Circassians in Turkey. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Papaga. There's a new hat we need to talk about. The Papaga hat and its history. Revolting are Ottoman Kurds. Tall Armenian t tale. The other side of the failed genocide. The creation of the Circassian flag is connected to the Pan-Circassian mission. Circassian paganism. The secret generational war on Circassians and Kurds. Are Georgians, Czechs, and other Caucasian people European or Mideastern? History of slavery in the Muslim world. Migration of Circassians to the Arab regions of the Ottoman Empire in the second half of the 19th century. Forced population movements in the Ottoman Empire and the early Turkish Republic, an attempt at reassessment. The Circassian exile, nine facts about the tragedy. Russia's unknown Circassian genocide. The secret generational war on Circassians and Kurds. The international aspect of Circassian involvement to the Young Turks movement in the 19th century. Banana Wars. The Banana Wars, how the U.S. plundered South America for corporations. Jewish Young Turks were murderers. Review of factors related to the thyroid cancer epidemic. I think I have that in here, but I don't know. The U.S. and the West intend to set fire in the Northern Caucasus. So, yeah, that will give us a pretty full agenda today. Here's what I think is going. Well, let me get back over here. Okay. I have only intimated, I put together somewhat of a timeline. The Banana Wars is a term coined for the conflicts involving the United States across Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean from 1898 to 1934, because today I will be talking about the big, huge trick that the Brits and the French used to rewire the entire Middle East. So I thought, well, while I'm at it, I might as well talk about the Banana Wars, which re-engineered that whole region. Though little remembered today, these were seminal conflicts in shaping American military doctrine, as well as the way the United States was viewed by its neighbors throughout the 20th century. John Foster Dulles, his brother's name was Allen Dulles. Okay, just have to keep two names straight here. So we have John Foster Dulles, his brother was Allen Dulles. Allen Dulles was head of the CIA under Eisenhower and also did legal work for United Fruit Company. So they go through this whole deal from the 1898. The objective of the operation was to enforce United States and private interests in Central America and the Caribbean. So for 36 years, 3 months, 1 week, and 4 days, this is what happened. Now, has this supposedly ended in 1934? But well, let's not get hung up on that right now. So anyway, so in Guatemala in 1954, United Fruit felt its profits threatened by enlightened labor and land reform policies. Among its stockholders were two powerful brothers, U.S. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles and CIA Director Allen Dulles. They arranged a coup which overthrew and set Guatemala on the path of strife that would eventually cost up to 200,000 innocent lives. In the year 1898, it marked the beginning of a campaign by three American fruit companies to secure land in Central and South America, as the countries of these regions were already weakened and unstable from constant political unrest. Their actions, in conjunction with the American government's pursuit of its own interests, were the catalyst for coups, assassinations, and disease that forever changed Latin America. The rise of the banana republics was a dark period for Latin America. So here again, we're going around that 1898 to the early 1930s, right? These actions range from backing Panamanian independence from Colombia in order to construct the Panama Canal to the military occupation of Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua. The relative vacuum of foreign and domestic competition allowed the fruit companies to monopolize trade for decades. The introduction of communism, they always bring in communism, and then through a lot of these coups, they just happen to bring in military rule, right? Well, that goes hand in hand with land theft and murder, right? The introduction of communism into the equation only allowed this trend to intensify, as the subsequent rhetoric was a direct threat to their business model of employing impoverished workers, such as the case in 1954, when after the United Fruit Company lobbied Congress, the elected communist government of Guatemala was overthrown by CIA-backed rebels. The fruit companies gradually lost their influence during the Cold War, while American motivations for military action changed from profit to ideology. However, the mark they left behind can be inherently felt in Latin America to this day. Yes, and those same Latin America countries are the ones that are out of money, and their people are now coming across the border into the United States. So I was also looking into, how does this stuff get started? Well, how does it get started that we view these people as these kind of like huge beacons of power and industry? They're so smart. They built all these things, right? I've been saying all along, they have been rolling out old technology that existed previously. We come from an advanced technological society. These people are not smart enough to design their way out of a box, okay? Why do you think there's been no real new things happening with computers? I have the worst audio in the world on this computer. You'd think by now they'd have that all together now, right? Well, not really, because they got us with this philosophy. And the philosophy is that these people are so great and so smart that we are lucky to have them. And how did that happen? Well, it happened by a person named Ayn Rand, actually a man, quite an ugly man. Ayn Rand was a man who was born in St. Petersburg and died March 1982 in New York. Ayn Rand also was heavily involved with Alan Greenspan. I'm starting to get the picture here, and I'll read this quote all the way through. When you notice that to produce, you need to get permission from those who do not produce anything. When you check that money flows to those who do not deal with goods, but with favors. When you realize that many become rich by the bribery and for influence more than by your work, and that the laws do not protect you against them, but on the contrary, they are the ones who are protected against you. When you discover that corruption is rewarded and honesty becomes self-sacrifice, then you can assert without fear of being wrong that your society is doomed. So, Ayn Rand and her acolyte, Alan Greenspan, Rand's theory is simple-minded and destructive on both a personal and society level. It holds that the selfish desires of the individual should have no restraints by government. The poor deserve their lot and should receive no tax support from other citizens, while the rich have a right to unrestricted power. Greenspan, Alan Greenspan, probably the ugliest woman on the planet, Alan Greenspan, former Fed chairman, not only worshipped at the feet of Rand, but wrote essays for her Objectionist newsletter and contributed articles for her book, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal. One of Greenspan's articles in the book is entitled Antitrust. Greenspan makes the same simplistic and deluded case as Rand that if government would only get out of the way, corporate leaders would move the country forward, and Greenspan wrote the following. The churning of nations' capital in a free, fully free economy would be continuously pushing capital into profitable areas, and this would effectively control the competitive price and production policies of business firms, making a coercive monopoly impossible to maintain. To sum up, the entire structure of antitrust statutes in this country is a jumble of economic irrationality and ignorance. If the product of a gross misinterpretation of history and of rather naive and certainly unrealistic economic theories, no speculation, however, is required to assess the injustice and the damage to the careers, reputation, and lives of business executives jailed under the antitrust laws. At the end of the treatise, Greenspan writes, "I am indebted to Ayn Rand for her identification of this principle." In addition to writing for Rand, Greenspan was a member of her collective in New York City. The collective, let me see here, The Hidden Struggles for America's Soul. For much of its existence, the collective was for all intent and purposes a cult. It had an unquestioned leader. It demanded absolute loyalty. It intruded into the personal lives of its members. It had its own rote expressions and catchphrases. It expelled transgressors for deviations from accepted norms, and expellees were fair game for vicious personal attacks. So yeah, he was quite close to Ayn Rand and her horrible thought process. Rand was not only a subpar thinker and writer, but a fake as well. She vilified government welfare programs, but collected Social Security. She wrote copious odes to the inherent morality of the intellectual elite, then had an extramarital affair with a younger man in her employ. She abhorred government intrusions, but testified willingly before the House Un-American Activities in 1947 about communist intrusions into Hollywood. So yeah, these people all have a double side. It's like all these losers online. So anyways, let me keep reading here. Both Rand and Greenspan had early ties to corporate front groups. In the early 1930s, Rand wrote a novella that was eventually published in the United States in 1946 under the title Anthem by a corporate front group. In recent years, Anthem has been pumped into high schools across the U.S. and Canada with financial incentives to both teachers and students by a corporate-funded nonprofit tied to hedge funds. The book presents a frightening dystopian world engineered by an out-of-control government. On February 13, 1946, Rand wrote to this person, Leonard Reed, suggesting that he arrange for the publishing of Anthem. Rand had become the head of the Western Division of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in the 1930s and assumed the leadership of the Los Angeles branch and its 10,000 members in 1939. In the letter, Rand explains, "I don't want to issue Anthem as a regular book now because it is only a novelette and not big enough to follow The Fountainhead. But when you ask in your letter, why don't we get it published? Did you mean as a pamphlet, specifically by the pamphleteers? I think that might be a very good idea. If a fiction story fits in with the pamphleteers program, perhaps you might be able to arrange to sell it in a pamphlet in bookstores, and if so, might get quite a large sale on the strength of my following." The pamphleteers published Anthem in 1946. In the book, Invisible Hands, this person writes that another notable event happened in 1946. So Rand reached out to David Goodrich, the president of B.F. Goodrich Company, and the first free market think tank in the post-war period was founded. And that was called the Foundation for Economic Education. So right after the war, they came up with this group. According to the initial funding of $10,000 came from Con Ed, General Motors, U.S. Steel and Chrysler, many of the same individuals involved in the pamphleteers were involved in the foundation. So they say that Reed tapped Rand to serve as the FEE, which is the name of that group, as their ghost, asking her to read material he intended to publish to make sure it was ideological coherent. Fee is very much alive and has been charged by Greenpeace with being one of the climate denial front groups. So, yeah, they go on about all this stuff about Greenspan and stuff. Another one of Rand's assertions, throughout the centuries, there were men who took the first steps down new roads, armed with nothing but their own vision, is an example of incomplete thinking and faulty logic. See, she suggested that some men are genuinely self-made and that they alone were the pavers of their new roads. But Isaac Newton's famous non-sequitur, which is inscribed in the milled edge of the $2 coin, "If I had seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants," comes closer to reality. So this was that famous quote, which is pretty good. It says, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." But Ayn Rand and them, Ayn Rand gave permission to people to be selfish and greedy, just like Freud allowed them to indulge their sexual libido. In Ayn Rand's novels, the heroes pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They made big profits in unfavored economic climates. Try pulling yourself up by your shoelaces. It can't be done. It's all storytelling with no basis in documented experience. Many have argued that the easy money policies of the Fed during Greenspan's tenure included the practice known as Greenspan PUT, where a leading cause of the dot-com bubble and subprime mortgage crisis tarnished his reputation. So, yeah, so that is how we got this idea. And, you know, they always write their backstories to represent themselves as being just these poor, ignorant people, just like the rest of us. Well, I don't consider myself poor or ignorant. They can say that all they want, but we have a choice if we elect to be victims of these psychos. Okay. back to the hat business for just a short bit here. The Moorish fez was considered to be a mark of high intelligence. By wearing one, a person claimed that he belonged to a highly evolved bloodline. If the fez is red in color, it symbolizes the supreme height of practical wisdom. So, I have some more here, just a little bit more about this fez that I was covering in the last show. So, where did I find the fez again? Well, I found the fez. The Circassians were wearing the fez hat. So, Circassian customs and social norms are enshrined in an orally transmitted code called the Circassian Etiquette. While the fez is not exclusive to Circassians, it has historical significance. So, they love the fatherland, bravery, and loyalty. The fez was part of this cultural context. So, the Circassians also wore the fez. So, let me just give you a brief runaround of what happened. And I'll be giving you some more facts to back this up. But in general, what I'll be talking about today, I started off with this group of Circassians, okay? They were over in the Russia area, and I'll be telling more of their story in a minute here. But they were basically driven off their land. And as they were driven off their land, and most of them were slaughtered, they were offered boat rides to go over to Turkey. A lot can happen on a boat ride, right? We learned that from the Irish. You can tell somebody where the boat is going, but how would they really know, right? So they got all these Circassians to flee to Turkey. Well, while they're in Turkey, we have World War I happen. We have the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And we have this secret deal that was cooked up. So what came first and what came second? I don't really know, but at that particular juncture in time, when the Ottoman Empire was supposedly going away, the UK and France met to come up with this secret agreement to reshape the entire Middle East. And that is exactly why the Middle East is shaped the way it is today. So, and I guess they've just been rewriting history. So I don't really know what do people understand about that part of the history, but I like to look at how things got started. So let me tell it from this perspective, okay? Because I thought at first I was just looking into the Circassians, but it ended up being a huge, huge, huge picture. And the Circassians ended up being part of the elite groups in Turkey. So how did these people who were rushed out of Russia, a lot of them were murdered, and how did that percentage of them end up running in the elite circles once they landed in Turkey? None of it starts to add up, right? But then it all really adds up. So between 1574, I'm going to run you down my, let me see, this is where my little checklist starts here. Let me see my timeline. Yeah, okay, this is how my timeline starts, okay? How did I come up with these wild ideas, right? Between 1574 and 1896, that's the global context of colonization, wars, and conquest, okay? A lot was going on around then. Spain also wanted to conquer many lands and was expected to. If it weren't for its fateful role in World War I, some even argue that the empire, we're talking about the Ottoman Empire, might have survived. This historian at Cornell University believes the Ottoman Empire had the potential to evolve into a modern, multi-ethnic, multilingual federal state. Instead, he argues World War I triggered the empire's disintegration. The Ottoman Empire joined the losing side. As a result, when the war ended, the division of territories of the Ottoman Empire was decided by the victors. Well. Now, isn't that just fascinating, right? Because we know that this was all planned. This is the plan, not the bug in the system. So they had already decided that the Ottoman Empire would be on the other side, right? So at its apex, the Ottoman Empire included Bulgaria, Egypt, Greece, Hungary, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, Macedonian, Romania, Syria, parts of Arabia, and the north coast of Africa. So the Ottoman Empire had all that territory, right? At its peak in the 1500s, the Ottoman Empire was one of the biggest military and economic powers in the world, controlling an expanse that included not just its base in Asia Minor, but also much of Southeastern Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. The empire controlled territory that stretched from the Danube to the Nile with a powerful military, lucrative commerce, and impressive achievements in fields ranging from architecture to astronomy. But it didn't last. Why did the Ottoman Empire fail? Though the Ottoman Empire persisted for 600 years, it succumbed to what most historians describe as a long, slow decline, despite efforts to modernize. Finally, after fighting on the side of Germany in World War I and suffering defeat, the empire was dismantled by treaty and came to an end in 1922 when the last Ottoman Sultan, Mehmed, was deposed and left the capital of Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, in a British warship. So in 1922, the last Ottoman Sultan, this person, Mehmed the Sixth, Mehmed, was deposed, and he left Constantinople, now Istanbul, in a British warship. From the Ottoman Empire's remains arose the modern nation of Turkey. And you know how I got here? I got here because a few years ago I read that they were selling white slaves in Turkey. And then when I heard about the Circassians and that they were white slaves in Turkey, that is exactly how. And then all of a sudden I figured out, well, I'm getting a lot of help, okay? That's why I encourage you to have silence in your life. I had no idea when I started that this had to do with, I'd only heard the word Ottoman Empire, okay? Let's get real. That's all I really had in my brain. I didn't really know how it ended. I didn't know how it started. I didn't even really know where it was, except kind of over in that geographical area. So all I'm trying to do is encourage you, keep looking. Okay, so this gets good, okay. So for the past 90 years, the defining characteristics of the Middle East, remember, since these people got over, right? It's been about 90 years. Okay. For the past 90 years, the defining characteristics of the Middle East has been political instability. Gee, I wonder how that happened. Well, soon we're going to find out. European colonial empires, which brought stability to other parts of the world, well, that's what they say, right? We're going to bring you democracy and you're going to be voting next week. Let us bring you that democracy. Okay, so European colonial empires, which brought stability to other parts of the world, had little steadying effect here. The heyday of British and the French dominion over the region lasted only 25 years, and that included World War II. By 1958, their political and economic influence had been eliminated from Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, and Egypt. Well, none of this is true, right? We know that CIA is now running things, but I'll keep reading. By 1962, the French were gone from Algeria, or so they think, where they had been for more than 130 years, and the Italians had been in Libya so briefly that if you blinked, you would have missed them. However brief, European rule over the Middle East was not quiet. And then it seemed, then I started wandering around, right? Because I was very confused by this group called the Young Turks. Just keep that in your mind, okay? The Young Turks. So I'll keep reading here. And I'm reading from this quote. It seems to me... Okay. It seems to me that it was Rothschilds who were standing behind plans to weaken Turkey as a state through Jewish organization, aka Young Turks, and thus weaken Turkish rule over Palestine. So this is a predominant theory that a lot of people seem to have. And I probably tend to agree with them, right? Because was the early theory to weaken Turkey and thus weaken Turkey's rule over Palestine? All this was done in preparation to create an Israeli state. World War I was ignited to destroy the Ottoman Empire, and World War II to create sense of guilt and sympathy, the Holocaust, for the newly created Israeli state. And then the person said, really clever people those Jews are. Well, it was really the Jesuits, but still, World War I was ignited to destroy Ottoman Empire, and World War II to create sense of guilt and sympathy. So, along with this, there was a big Armenian genocide. What do Armenians mean? Well, Armenians were called LMN, EL, which, remember, elites come from L, right? Elites come from Saturn, which comes from L. So here we got the Armenians were called LMN, E-M-I-N-N. No, E-M-I-N. And that means trustful or trustworthy people. So that's what the name of Armenians means, the trusted one. The prophet's nickname given to by people around him. Okay, so what happened before all this stuff? Well, I was going through this whole timeline of things. So before we get to the 1800s and the whole deal with Ottoman Empire, the U.S. gets founded 1776. What was interesting was this, and keep this in your mind, the German Illuminati was born in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt. Now, that was 2 months prior to the Declaration of Independence. Weishaupt was a son of a Jewish rabbi. He became a Jesuit priest prior to becoming an atheist before becoming a Satanist. He studied in France. He also performed occult rituals. Okay, so... then in 1776. 1787 to 1791, there was a Russian-Turkish war. What was that about? So, 1829, 1838 Anglo-Turkish Commercial Convention removed any local monopolies in Turkey, allowing British trade and merchants to dominate the area. So they went in and used the money card, right? So they got rid of local monopolies and allowed the British to dominate the area. The economic dealings of Europe in the 19th century had damaging effects on Ottoman fiscal sovereignty. So then in 1851, this guy took over the Illuminati, and let me see, doesn't matter. Okay, then 1855, after the campaigns in the Caucasus Mountains that I was talking about in the last show, they introduced this new hat. I kid you not. The new hat is called the Papakha, Papakha. It looks like a fez hat, but it's made with fur. In 1855, after the campaigns in the Caucasus Mountains, the Papakha was introduced in the Russian army as an official part of the uniform for the Saskas, and later for the rest of the cavalry. So, at the beginning of the 19th century, Ottoman and Russian nationalism began to become heated as both countries struggled to control their Muslim populations and the land they inhabited. So then we have the Crimea War. The Crimea War saw a large-scale exodus of Muslims from Russia into the Ottoman capital of Istanbul. So we have a bunch of them from Russia going into the Ottoman Empire. Russian policy from the 1860s began to involve forcible evictions of Muslim inhabitants, with over 200,000 Muslims arriving in Istanbul after the war, causing a large strain on the already weak Ottoman economy. So that was from the 1860s. Well, the American Civil War just happened to begin in 1861 due to tensions over slavery, slave rights, and expansion. Seven southern states split from the Confederate States of America after Abraham Lincoln was elected president in 1860, and four additional states later joined them. With the Confederate surrender in 1865, the conflict, also known as the War Between the States, came to an end. So, around the same time, March the 6th and May 1864, almost the entire population, a prominent Circassian tribe, were exiled to Anatolia in the Ottoman Empire. The Circassians were seen as a Muslim threat and expelled from Bulgaria and other parts of the Balkans by Russian armies following the end of the Russo-Turkish War. They were not allowed to return, so the Ottoman authorities settled them in new other lands, such as modern Jordan, Israel, Palestine, Syria, and Turkey. By 1867, three-fourths of the population was annihilated, and the Circassians had become one of the first stateless people in modern history. During the Tanzimat period, 1839 to 1876, it was characterized by reforms aimed at modernizing Ottoman society. The major Western influence and the break away from traditional Ottoman values is best captured by the Tunisian Organic Law of 1857, which for the first time set the regulations for governments in one of the Ottoman territories in non-Islamic terms. So they have the 200,000 Muslims arriving in Istanbul after the war, causing a large strain. These nationalist movements, influenced by the West, would culminate in the expansion of separate national agendas of Armenian, Arab, Turk, and Balkan statehood, leading the racial hierarchies in the early part of the 20th century, fueled by the Balkan expulsion of Muslims in 1878. The blemish of racism within the Ottoman state would tear its people and eventually the nation itself apart. The term commonly used to describe the institutional framework governing relations between the Ottoman state and its large and varied non-Muslim population. A further problem was that the millet system merely defined minority groups but did not extend full nationality. So, yeah, the empire came under power, but what is with all these Muslims, right? Well, so now we were back there. Now, what happened next? Okay, so that was they came up with this Tunisian Organic Law, 1857. So they're kicking out all these people. All these people are getting murdered, right? Well, what happened? Well, the phrase orphan train was first used in 1854 to describe the transportation of children from their home area via the railroad. The term orphan train was not used widely until long after the orphan train program had ended. So here's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that the orphan train program happened from 1854 to 1929. Well, when you're loading up boats of people, having them flee the area, all those Circassian people that were getting loaded onto boats and supposedly heading to Turkey, how hard would it be to have some of those boats land in the United States and drop the kids off here, right? In the same year, mass deep let me see yeah, this was in Turkey. Okay, in the same year, mass deportation. Some died from epidemics or starvation among the crowds of deportees and were reportedly eaten by dogs after their death. Others died when the ships underway sank during storms. So yeah, how hard? I mean, they tricked a lot of people coming over here. So, how hard would it be to say, okay, we're going to put the kids over here on this boat, and then over here, we're going to put the adults over here on this boat? And well, what happened en route? Did a lot of these Circassian people get dumped overboard, and the ones that came off the boat alive were really the Jesuits? Really, I mean, you got to think about it, right? Because at the same time, let me see. Also, that crazy Mecca temple with that fez hat started in 1872. Also, along with the orphan trains, we also had another program called the New York Foundling Hospital. And this was like a catalog. And you could actually, the orphan trains basically rolled into all these towns, loaded up with children, and people came and picked the kids, right? The Foundling Hospital was different because you would write them a letter and say, well, my husband and I are good Christians, and we're looking for a blonde-haired boy with blue eyes. So you could actually order your children. So the New York Foundling Hospital was established here again, 1869. So by these Sisters of Charity as a shelter for abandoned, they act like children are just being abandoned all over the place, right? The sisters working in conjunction with priests throughout the Midwest and South in an effort to place these children in Catholic families. The Foundling Hospital sent infants and toddlers to pre-arranged Roman Catholic homes from 1875 to 1914. So that was 1875, right? Well, then in 1878, we had what was called the Ottoman Scramble for Africa. And that supposedly challenges the narrative of an exclusively defensive and inwardly looking empire following the Russian-Ottoman War of 1877 to 1878 and the loss of much of the Balkan provinces. Contrary to the commonly accepted understanding of the post-1878 Ottoman Empire, it argues that the Ottoman government's efforts after the Congress, they call it the, when they carved up Africa, they called it the Congress of Berlin, okay? So it argued that the Ottoman government's efforts after the Congress of Berlin were not simply survival strategies requiring a necessary withdrawal from the world of late 19th century competitive imperialism. So what they're saying is it seems suspicious, okay? Well, yes. In fact, the 1880s and 1890s witnessed a reinvigorated Istanbul that followed competitive strategies that cannot simply be attributed to an ideological aversion to the West, the paranoia of a besieged sultan, or the government's rhetoric of pan-Islamic coming from the mythologized seat of power in Istanbul, the Palace of Stars. The palace of Sultan blah 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 was much more than his residence. In many ways, it resembled the White House in Washington, a place where much of the state's business was discussed under the watchful eye of its head. Whew. The Russo-Turkish War, 1870. See what I'm saying? They have all these wars, right? Part of what the Armenians consider to be their homeland, the Kars Andragan region, had been taken from the Ottomans, and there was good reason to expect that the rest of Armenia would soon be in Russian hands. So yeah, so they got these Armenians, right? Because that Berlin West Africa Conference was held between 15 November 1884 and 26 February 1885, was an event where the principles of the colonization of Africa were determined by the great powers, also known as the white demons. Just kidding. I call them white demons. I didn't just read that, I made it up. As an African state, at the same time, the Ottoman Empire was one of the states that participated in the conference. So, who are these Young Turks? The Young Turks was a broad opposition movement in the late Ottoman Empire agitating against Sultan's absolute regime. The most powerful organization of the movement and the most conflated was the Committee of Union and Progress, or CUP. Though its goals, strategies, and membership continuously morphed through their reign, by the 1890s, the Young Turks, keep that name in mind, were mainly a loose and contentious network of intelligentsia exiled in Western Europe and Egypt that made a living by selling their newspapers to secret subscribers. At first, the Ottoman Empire decided to remain neutral. They were not nearly as strong as any of the other nations fighting in the war and were racked by internal and external threats. The Ottoman Sultan was nothing more than a figurehead at this point, with the last powerful Sultan having been overthrown in 1908 and replaced with a military government led by the three pashas. PASHAS. I think the pashas are the ones who are wearing that hat. This one, Abu Mabhet, was the last of the Ottoman sultans who had any real power. He was overthrown in 1909 by a group known as the Young Turks. They were Western educated, liberal secularists who vehemently disagreed with the Islamic direction that the last sultan took from 1876 to 1909. A complex and intricate course of events in the 1910s brought about the end of the Ottomans and the rise of the new nations with borders running across the Middle East, dividing Muslims from each other. So, yeah, I'm not really tracking this whole Muslim deal, but it appears to me that they went into a predominantly Muslim area and just decided they were just going to mix it up, right? Change the borders around, all that kind of stuff. So they make this big complex thing in 1910s, right? But then there was a 1915 to 1923 Armenian genocide where 500,000 Armenians perished in a barbaric way in their ancestral lands in modern Turkey. They were actually drawn up and were placed, oh, excuse me, actually were drawn up and in place by the year 1910. Or, yeah, so right after they get these plans drawn up, well, they killed them all. In Istanbul, which was the capital and the power center of the Ottoman Empire, where there were only a few thousand Jews and some 200,000 Armenians and Greeks who controlled the trade, finances, and arts of the empire. So we have a lot of Armenians controlling the finances and arts of the Ottoman Empire. Start to get it suspicious, right? Jews and Christians were in stiff competition throughout hundreds of years of the life of the empire. Jews were the losers and Christians were the winners, always because the sultans listened to and favored the Christians. For the Zionist Jews to take over Turkey, its Christians had to be eliminated, and that is another ugly facade of the first genocide of the 20th century, which took place in Turkey. Then there was this person who wrote this book, and this is an interesting quote that I put in here, and it says, "It would be fair to say that the genocide of a group of 1 million or so to serve the benefit of 1 billion or so in the Far East is less of a question of should it be done than how it could be done. So as not to reveal any plausible motive which could link the actual planners to the genocide, the scheme involved a proxy party, namely the Muslims, Turks, Kurds, and Azeris, which was manipulated through layers of influence, providing sufficient cover for the planners." There was a book, and it said they launched this person that launched the group called the Young Turks is named Palmerson. Palmerson launches the Young Turks to permanently control the Middle East, claims the founder of the Young Turks, who is a certain Jew by the name of Emmanuel Carasso, Carasso. So this founder of the Young Turks named Carasso. This is his direct quote. Carasso set up the Young Turks secret society in the 1890s in Salonika, then part of Turkey and now part of Greece. Carasso was also the grand master of an Italian Masonic lodge there called Macedonia Resurrected. The lodge was the headquarters of the Young Turks, and all the top Young Turk leadership were members. During the Young Turk regime, Carasso continued to play a leading role. He met with the Sultan to tell him that he was overthrown. He was in charge of putting the Sultan under house arrest. He ran the Young Turk intelligence network in the Balkans, and he was in charge of all food supplies in the empire during World War I. It is ironic that 4 centuries after the Turkish sultans welcomed and expelled European Jews into Turkey, certain Jews belonging to secret societies and to Zionism will kick the Sultan out of power in early 20th century, destroy the Ottoman Empire, and celebrate their victory by massacring by proxy almost the whole Christian Armenian people, 1.5 million Armenians, 500,000 Greeks, and 500,000 Christian Azerbaijanis and Armenians. So yeah, that's what they do. If you ever make an agreement with a psychopath, just sit there and wait for the knife to come into your back. You will be cheering and laughing and thinking, oh, this is great. We're going to join together and get all these people. And then, come on, they're going to get you. Okay, who was this Emmanuel Caruso? He was an Ottoman lawyer. That's surprising, right? And also a member of the prominent Sephardic Jewish Caruso family of Ottoman Salonia. He was also a prominent member of the Young Turks. One of the British strategies was to turn the Ottoman Empire Arab subjects against the government. They found a ready and willing helper in the Hejaz, H-E-J-A-Z, the western region of the Arabian Peninsula. Sharif Hussein bin Ali, the Amir, A-M-I-R, governor of Maqaba, entered into an agreement with the British government to revolt against the Ottomans. So they set up by proxy, this guy. He entered into an agreement with the British government to revolt against. It's the same game book they have always used, right? Get somebody to turn on their own people. The British provided support in the form of soldiers, weapons, money, advisors, including the legendary Lawrence of Arabia, and a flag. The British in Egypt drew up a flag for the Arabs to use in battle, which was known as the Flag of the Arab Revolt. This flag would later become the model for other Arab flags of countries such as Jordan, Palestine, Sudan, Syria, and Kuwait. So they all share the same flag design, okay? Just like they all wear that Iron Cross. The Nazis wear it, the church is wearing it, the royal people are wearing that. They're all wearing the same things, okay? Okay. First of only two global wars in history, it was also called the Great War. The First World War was fought between 1914 and 1918, claiming 17 million lives. It resulted in the victory of Britain, France, and Russia over Germany, Italy, Austria, and Hungary. The League of Nations was formed after the First World War, but it failed to ensure world peace, and eventually World War II was fought. No, actually what they did was they formed the League of Nations, and they're the ones who helped them chop up the Middle East. History Collection explains that the Russian Civil War was fought mainly between the Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, and the White Army, a collection of forces opposing the communists. No, opposed to the communists. Yeah, they're opposed to the communists. Between 1917 and 1922, a stunning 9 million people died in the conflict as these groups fought over the carcass of the large Russian Empire. However, it should be noted that this was a time of chaos and records were spotty. So then, you know, then the Cold War, I don't know why that's here. So 1914, war broke out in Europe, a complex system of alliances, a militaristic arms race, colonial ambitions, and general mismanagement at the highest government levels led to this devastating war that claimed the lives of 12 million people from 1914 to 1918. On the Allied side stood the empires of Britain, France, and Russia. Now, what's missing from this? The Americans, right? The Central Powers consisted of Germany and Austria-Hungary. They were from the secular westernized group, the Young Turks. Financially, the Ottomans were in a serious bind, owing huge debts to the European powers that they were not able to pay. After trying to join the Allied side and being rejected, the Ottomans sided with Central Powers in 1914. So how'd they get all this going? Well, before the Arab Revolt could even begin, and before Sharif Hussein could create his Arab kingdom, the British and French had other plans. In the winter of 1915 and 1916, two diplomats, Sir Mark Sykes, S-Y-K-E-S, of Britain, and François Picot, P-I-C-O-T, of France, secretly met to decide the fate of the post-Ottoman Arab world. According to what would become known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the British and French agreed to divide up the Arab world between themselves. The British were to take control of what are now Iraq, Kuwait, and Jordan. The French were given modern Syria, Lebanon, and South Turkey. The Sykes-Picot Agreement was a 1916 secret treaty between the United Kingdom and France with assent from the Russian Empire and the Kingdom of Italy. So essentially, they all agreed, right? To define their mutually agreed spheres of influence and control in an eventual partition of the Ottoman Empire. Although it was meant to be a secret agreement for a post-World War I Middle East, the agreement became publicly known in 1917 when the Russian Bolshevik government exposed it. The Sykes-Picot Agreement directly contradicted the promises the British made to Sharif Hussein and caused a considerable amount of tension between the British and Arabs. However, this would not be the last of the conflicting agreements the British would make. This is a pretty good example, right? They make an agreement, but they craft it, so it's always going to be the opposite of what you think it is. In June of 1916, Sharif Hussein led his group of armed Bedouin warriors from the Hejaz in an armed campaign against the Ottomans. Within a few months, the Arab rebels managed to capture numerous cities in Hejaz, including with help from the British Army and Navy. So, during World War One, they just got together, right? During World War I, the foreign ministries of France, Russia, Britain, and Italy assigned a group of selected diplomats to hold talks that would determine each country's share of the inheritance of the Ottoman Empire, which at that stage was dubbed the Sick Man. the sick man, S-I-C-K man. Between November 15 and May 1916, secret negotiations were made. Britain was the most powerful party among these countries. It was at the same time in contact with the Emir and Sharif of Mecca, Hussein bin Ali, who had been plotting for a revolution that aimed at establishing an Arab kingdom in the region. So what they did was they just secretly got this guy to agree, right? On the second entry combined Northern Iraq, Jordan, blah, blah. The third entry included a coastal area that extended from southern Lebanon to the north. This part was under direct French control. So yeah, disclosure of the agreement. When Russian Tsar Nicholas II was overthrown by a popular revolution in 1917, the Bolshevik communists, led by Vladimir Lenin, found a copy of the Sykes-Picot Agreement in the government's archive records. Did that really happen? Oh, I don't know. Lenin's colleague, Leon Trotsky, published a copy of the agreement in this newspaper in an attempt to expose the great power's plans to inherit the Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. Lenin called the treaty the Agreement of the Colonial Thieves. The exposure of the agreement caused a political scandal for Britain and France. So this is why it happened, because this Al-Sharif person, Britain during its negotiations with Sharif al-Bin took up the responsibility of establishing a home base for the Jewish people in Palestine. This came from a letter written November 2, 1917, by then British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour to Baron Walter Rothschild, a close friend of Zionist movement leader Chaim Weizmann. The British commitment was endorsed in 1920. So this British Zionist arrived in Palestine as Britain's first high commissioner for the country. In that year, the British Mandate of Palestine was formalized by the League of Nations in a special article in its legislation. Boy, that League of Nations sure turned out to be pretty handy now, didn't they? Following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and Britain's capture of Palestine and Iraq, Britain gave up the ideas of partitioning the Ottoman Empire properties as initially proposed in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Instead, it focused on the mandate system approved in the San Remo Conference that was held in France on April 1920 and aimed at defining the destiny of the occupied Arab Orient provinces. So right there at that particular point in time, they were all cooking up this stuff. The San Remo Conference was an international meeting of the post-World War I Allied Supreme Council as an outgrowth of the Paris Peace Conference held in Italy. The San Remo resolution passed determined the allocation of Class A League of Nations mandates for the administration of three undefined Ottoman territories in the Middle East, Palestine, Syria, and Mesopotamia. The boundaries of these three territories were to be determined at a later date by the principal Allied powers, leaving the status of outlying areas such as Zoar and Transjordan unclear. Well, so that is exactly why they're over there right now acting like they're blowing up the Middle East. A century on, why Arabs resent Sykes-Picot? Oh, besides the fact they changed everything. The borders of the Middle East were drawn during World War I by a Briton, Mark Sykes, and a Frenchman, Francois Picot. The two diplomats pencils divided the map of one of the most volatile regions in the world into states that cut through ethnic and religious communities. Later dubbed the Sykes-Picot Treaty, the secret agreement was signed by Paris and London on May 16, 1916, to become the basis on which the Levant region was shaped for years to come. A century on, the Middle East continues to bear the consequences of the treaty, and many Arabs across the region continue to blame the subsequent violence in the Middle East, from the occupation of Palestine to the rise of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Lebanon, or ISIL. They blame it on the Sykes-Picot Treaty. So yeah, I would blame it on them too. There is a lot about all of this, and I have the article there for you to take a look at. Basically, they just decided for the worst possible thing to happen would be to throw all of these boundaries into turmoil, right? Slice and dice all these people from all these different countries. So you got some people from here, some people from there. Then you start fighting amongst the people. See how this all works. Sykes was a English political advisor, diplomat, politician, military man, and traveler. He represented his country in secret talks. Sykes, who was born into a wealthy family, published a number of books while still in his 20s. His work included 2 books on military science and 3 on the Ottoman Empire. Of course, they all came from wealthy family, but this, I don't know if this is true or not, so I'll try not to laugh too hard. Sykes died of the Spanish flu pandemic in 1919 in Paris, where he was attending a peace conference. So he's attending a peace conference, and he dies of the Spanish flu in Paris in 1919. Pretty ironic, isn't it? He never got to see how the maps he drew materialized on the ground and changed the face of the Middle East for years to come. So this Picot person was a diplomat and the son of a historian. Another powerful person, right? A member of the French colonial party. Oh, yeah, another impressive person. He was later appointed as minister in Bulgaria and Argentina. They always like to return to the scene of the crime, right? Go to some country, starve the people to death, murder a whole bunch of them, and then get the posh job to go over there and look at them all, right? So there is a whole lot about these articles, and I will leave them for you to take a look at. They claim that, there's just a lot to how they carved all this up, right? So they basically did all this to throw everybody into a tizzy, right? Their motto is order out of chaos, right? Okay, the borders, 100 years later. Yeah, 100 years later, they're still pretty much screwed up, right? So here's a couple little tricks they did here. Egypt and Iraq signed treaties with Britain that practically prevented them from getting their independence until the two monarchies were overthrown in 1952 and 1958. During the war, France's government pledged to grant independence to the countries under its mandate amidst the loudening voices of the local political class that called for independence. Syria and Lebanon gained independence 2 years before the end of World War II. Let me see. On a spring day in 1948, Britain ended its mandate in Palestine. Hours later, the Jewish leadership, led by future Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, declared the establishment of a Jewish state, to be known as the State of Israel. The British had, before and during the war, called for the migration of European Jews to Palestine, paving the way for the establishment of that new state. The international role of the British and French began to dwindle in the aftermath of the 1956 Suez Crisis. So there was some crisis going on. Yeah, I could be here until, well, anyway, so. So, yeah, they, how much of this was a scheme and how much of it was real? I don't know. The League of Nations was an organization for international cooperation. So the League was the one to draw up the borders we see on modern political. Boy, this is convenient, isn't it? Just like they always investigate themselves, right? They literally cooked up the League of Nations to do all this stuff, right? Now, I wasn't there. I'm just merely guessing, right? The League was one to draw up the borders. So the borders we see on modern political maps of the Middle East, the borders were drawn up without regard for the wishes of the people living there or along ethnic, geographical, or religious boundaries. They were truly arbitrary. It is important to note that even today, political borders in the Middle East do not indicate different groups of people. The differences between Iraqis, Syrians, Jordanians, etc. were entirely created by the European colonizers as a method of dividing the Arabs against each other. So yeah, that was the whole plot, right? Through the mandate system, the British and the French were able to get the control they wanted over the Middle East. For Sharif Hussein, his sons were allowed to rule over these mandates under British protection. Prince Faisal was made king of Iraq and Syria, and Prince Abdul was made king of Jordan. In practice, however, the British and French had real authority over these areas. So, yeah, I think it's pretty crazy that people think that they're free, right? So I got to get to these Circassians. Why did they show up? And I'm going to take a break here. Okay, so why did these Circassians? Let's talk about them for a minute here, right? That's how this whole story got started. Circassians have played major roles in areas where they settled in Turkey. Those of Circassian origin have had massive influence, being instrumental in the Turkish War of Independence and among the elites of Turkey's intelligence agencies. In Jordan, they founded the capital city, Amman, and continue to play a major role in the country. In Syria, they served as the guards of the Allies against the Nazis and still have high positions. In Libya, they serve in high military positions. In Egypt, they were part of the ruling class. They also contributed to cultural literacy, intellectual, and political life, starting with the reign of Mohammed al-Pasha and continuing to the modern day, especially through the country's largest Circassian clan, the Abaza, A-B-A-Z-A family. So what does that all mean? What does that all mean? Why are we circling around this area? Who were these Circassians? And how did they end up being? Because they were traditionally known as mountaineers, right? For over 100 years, between 1763 and 1864, the Circassians fought Russian armies in mountains of Caucasia. The Circassians deployed effective guerrilla warfare tactics against the Russians during the war. But power struggles among Circassian tribes and internal disagreements between chiefs and commoners created serious problems for the resistance. In addition, the Circassians did not establish effective military alliances with other Caucasian people, even though they had a common enemy. Despite this, the Circassians fought hard to prolong the war and used tactics which frustrated Russian military strategists in ways they never expected. The Russian army developed a new strategy of retribution in the early 1800s against Circassian raids. Russian troops were ordered to attack villages where the families of supposed Circassian fighters were living. The Russians conducted various assassinations and kidnappings in order to wipe out the broad rural support Circassian fighters long enjoyed as Highlanders. Russia also destroyed crops and livestock, leaving Circassian commoners with no ways to survive. They were eventually forced to submit to Russian rule or expelled from their villages. They had a choice, death or exile. So, so they said that, get out of here, right? He said that eliminating the Circassians was to be an end in itself, to cleanse the land of hostile elements. His plans were approved by Tsar Alexander II, and somebody was positioned not long after Russian military commander proposed that the Circassians should be expelled to the Ottoman Empire. He said that the Circassians should choose one or two options, death or allegiance to the Russian Empire. So this guy, the last field marshal of Russia, I couldn't help but notice he's wearing an Iron Cross. Okay. Between March the 6th and May 1864, almost the entire population of the Yubanks, a prominent Circassian tribe, were exiled to Anatolia in the Ottoman Empire. The expulsion was so massive that the Russian Empire could not find enough farmers to cultivate the fertile lands of Western Caucasia. Circassians now all over the world mark May the 21st as a day of remembrance of their tragic exile. Circassian activists currently estimate that 90% of Circassian, around 3 million people, were banished from Circassia by Russia during the expulsion process. So, the same year, however, seen differently by the Russian Empire, it viewed the killing and expelling of the Circassians as a great victory for its national aims and a cause for celebration. Now, why is that? What other people were getting kicked out? Well, the Jews and the Jesuits all claim they were kicked out all over the place too, right? So the Circassians are yapping about being kicked out. The Russia's Caucasian army said, and this is a quote, "In this year, a deed has been accomplished almost without precedent in history. Not one of the mountaineer inhabitants remains on their former places of residence, and measures are being taken to cleanse the region. The expulsions were carried out to prepare Caucasia to be settled by Christian Russians." Imperial Russian records claim more than 400,000 Circassians were killed and 497,000, no, well, close to 500,000 were forced to flee abroad to Turkey. Only 80,000 were left alive in their native land. They called it the floating graveyards. So the Ottoman Empire, they sent ships over to bring Circassians to Anatolia. During the mass exodus, thousands of Circassians lost their lives on the water of the Black Sea. Disease and drowning were some of the main causes of death. The Black Sea became the resting place of thousands during the Grim Journey. The Ottoman Empire's Circassian settlement policy, which was seen by some as a means to exert greater control over its Christian population, has been criticized on the grounds that it was poorly planned and executed. Yeah, I mean, how hard would it be to tell everybody, I'm going to kill all of you, get on this boat? Yeah, so you get everybody on the boat, and then maybe there was a core group of Circassians who had infiltrated the whole group, right? And that's what they always do. So maybe they had a group of Jesuits or, I don't know, agents in there as part of the whole group that fled, right? So then you get all those people on the boat. So you get the adults on one boat, you get the children on another boat. Well, they couldn't really be stopped by that point, right? If you're fleeing for your life, you can't really say, oh, no, I'm not going on that boat. I'm going to go on that boat. No, you don't have those decisions at that point, right? So it would be pretty easy to put all those children on a boat, dock all those kids over New York, dump them off here, and then say that the other boat is going to Turkey. Because even if the boat was going next door to another country, they could take you across the world on a boat. And how would you know it? How would you know that that wasn't how you got there, right? So, yeah, it'd be pretty easy to get people to flee. So maybe the core group was on the boats, right? So the core group is on the boats. So what do? Well, they start hucking people off the boat along the way, right? Could be. I mean, you have to almost kind of think like a criminal, right? So let me see here. This is a good part here. Now, so why was I back here? Well, because in the 16th century, Sir Francis Bacon was at the helm of the secret societies in England, and he offered his famous book, The New Atlantis. Bacon's book was the blueprint for colonizing the United States, advocating that America would become a paradise in which men would follow reason, become gods, and work for a universal world republic that would then replicate the utopian conditions of America throughout the known world. Secret knowledge would be passed on through the generations by Freemasons and other secret societies. So this Lord Bacon was also chief of the Rosicrucians and the first Grand Master of modern Freemasonry. Bacon sent his followers to the New World, or was it the Old World? Who knows, right? In 1910, Newfoundland stamp with his image upon it reads, Lord Bacon, the guiding spirit in the colonization scheme. Why they call it a colonization scheme, right? And so then I started following the Rosicrucians for a while. In 1733, Rosicrucians Freemasonry formally entered America when the St. John's Lodge was established in Boston. It became the Masonic capital of Britain's colonies. By 1737, there were lodges in Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina, all committed to implementing the plan for a utopian New Atlantis. In 1731, Benjamin Franklin became a Rosicrucian Mason, and in 1734, Provisional Grand Master of Pennsylvania. Rosicrucianism is a spiritual and cultural movement that arose in early modern Europe in the early 17th century after the publication of several texts announcing to the world a new esoteric order. Rosicrucians is a symbol by the rosy cross or rose cross. There have been several Rosicrucian inspired organizations since the initial movement was founded, including the Order of the Golden and Rosy Cross, the Societies of Rosicrucian in Angola, and the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. So, so that all got started. But then another thing, after dark on December 1773, at least 120 Masons from the St. Andrew's Lodge, disguised as Mohawk Indians, boarded the ships and threw the tea into the harbor, allegedly to protest numerous taxes levied by King George III. So, yeah, I had no idea that the people who tossed the tea overboard were dressed up as Indians, or maybe I knew it, but maybe I forgot. But anyway, so in 1775, Thomas Paine, who Franklin had sent to America to work on the Pennsylvania Magazine, argued that America should demand independence from England. For over 100 years, between 1763 and 1864, the Crustaceans fought Russian armies. So they say it's because they were a neighbor next door. As it expanded, the Russian Empire wanted to break the connection between the Ottoman Empire and the Circassians. I don't know why that's happening, right? I have more questions than actually I have answers. They also wanted to get full control of the northeastern Black Sea, as the Ottomans controlled the southern Black Sea. Toward the end of the 100-year war between Russia and the Circassians, the Russian army in the northern Caucasus numbered some 300,000 men and was suffering losses of 30,000. The Russian state was spending a sixth of its budget on the task of defeating the Circassians and their allies. Russia was willing to defeat the Circassians at any cost, but following the end of the Caucasus War in 1864 between Russia and the Circassian people, in which Russia finally succeeded in destroying the Circassian armed forces, Tsar Alexander II decided that the Circassians should be forcibly expelled from Russia. The expulsion was launched before the official end of the war in 1864 and was mostly complete by 1867. The people planned for removal were mainly Circassians, but they had these Chechens and other groups were also affected. The Russian military began a systematic campaign of destroying Circassian villages and massacring their inhabitants in order to terrorize them so they would flee from Russia. So, yeah, so they terrorized them so they would leave. This is all starting to sound kind of familiar, right? And how did they end up over in Sochi? Because they were saying that Russia did the... They say that a lot of Circassians died there. And so a few years later, Circassians made their last stand at Sochi. To quote, in a cannon near Sochi called Quaba locally, the Circassian forces and some of their allies made their last stand against the Russian army in May 1864. The place was renamed to mean Red Meadow in Russian for all the blood that had been spilled there when it was later resettled by ethnic Russians in 1869. After the final battle in 1864, hordes of Circassians were driven to Sochi, where thousands of them died as they awaited deportation. Yeah, pretty crazy stuff, right? I think I've gotten enough of the picture here. Most Circassians settled in Turkey. Later historians regarded them as having played a key role in the history of Turkey. Circassians took active roles in the Ottoman state in high positions from their arrival until the collapse of their empire. After the collapse of the empire, Circassians in Turkey became the target of blatant campaigns of discrimination. So here they're getting discriminated against, right? And what I'm going to do is this. I am going to close off the show, and I will pick it up on the other end in a day or so, because I think what the picture is that, well, all that fighting going on in the Middle East, it didn't just happen, okay? I always thought this. Now, why did I think this? Well, because I was exposed to U.S. military, right? I always thought this. I thought, wow, all those arguments in the Middle East is because they're all arguing over religion. It's been going on for thousands of years. Who could possibly settle this problem? That's how it's been presented to the U.S. public, that all those people over the Middle East pay no mind. They're just a bunch of losers. They've been fighting forever. Can't do anything to fix. Look, we've been trying to help those people forever. All we do is try to help those people. And look, all we do is get a thumb in the eye. Every time we try to help the Middle East, they're out to get us. Yeah, well, I think the Middle East has pretty good reason for wanting to get people, right? And this is why I encourage you, always look for how this stuff got started. I had an idea that probably it was rigged up. And you notice nobody is mentioning the United States in this takeover, right? They're just talking about the UK and France. So what is the reason for that? Well, I'll be back with more of the story, because it has some very fascinating twists and turns. Very, very fascinating twists and turns between these Turks and these Armenians. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Well, you'll have to hang in there to find out. So be safe out there, and goodbye for now.